KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
For this specific show, I just knew I could do so much with the Cuban experience. So much of the pride I have in being Cuban and the stories that I have from my personal life, I wanted to use.
When Norman Lear decided to reboot the classic sitcom One Day at a Time, this time with a Latino family, he wanted a writer who could offer an authentic voice. But even Gloria Calderon Kellett was surprised when he picked her and let her build the show around a Cuban family. But first on the News Banter, more upheaval at Sony Pictures. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, wow, this has been quite a week for Sony. It actually started several days ago with an announcement that Michael Lynton, who is the head of Sony's entertainment operations, was out. And this is something that people had expected for quite some time. I don't think he was regarded as the most hands-on executive by any calculation. He presided over Sony when they made the interview, which begat the Sony hack. The Sony hack produced lots of emails showing that he had been actively looking for a job. Not that many people can do those things and still get promoted and continue to be employed, but Michael Lynton did do that. Finally, he's out. He's landing very softly at Snapchat. He's going to be the chairman. They're going to go public. He's going to make a fortune, which drives people in Hollywood crazy, considering that he's not considered the most vigorous of executives. However, be that as it may, this opens up the whole cauldron of what is going to happen at the Sony film studio.
Right. And I think first and foremost is the future of Tom Rothman, who is running the film studio and has suffered through a 2016, I think, that he would like to forget, with a number of films that just didn't work. Some of them are his films that he greenlit, like Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, and some of them are not, like the Ghostbusters remake, which he inherited, but that was not what they wanted. They finished fifth out of sixth in domestic market share for Sony, and worse, you know, some of the projects in the pipeline are just not perceived as being on the A-level franchise list that, you know, these studios need. So it'll be interesting to see how this exit and whoever replaces Michael Lynton will impact Tom Rothman down the road.
Yeah, there's some thought that they will maybe bring in this guy, Andrew House, who's a PlayStation guy, and try to sort of marry hardware and software, which was the original plan years ago when Akio Morita, the founder of Sony, bought Columbia Pictures. He was thinking about Betamax and trying to make that format the standard. That didn't work. Nothing married hardware and software in the intervening years, but PlayStation is big, and maybe they have a shot to create programming for PlayStation. There's a possibility they'll make a deal and sell the assets or not part of the assets. Who knows? It's adding to this environment of instability in the industry. And that is not where the challenges of Sony ended this week. We saw the departure of a hugely important talent on the TV side.
Yeah, Jerry Seinfeld, who he had a very successful show on Crackle, the Sony streaming service called Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, got an Emmy nomination. He just up and left and went to Netflix this past week for a deal that we're told could approach $100 million for specials and the library of Comedians in Cars, plus new original episodes of that show. Netflix making a huge play for Jerry Seinfeld, but left in the cold is Sony. And, you know, that basically came from a relationship that Seinfeld had with Steve Mosko, who ran Sony Pictures Television. Mosko was shown the door this last year.
Yeah, and one of the few things I can think of that Michael Lynton did was to get rid of Steve Mosko.
Right. And Michael, yeah, Steve Mosko is out this past year. Seinfeld basically said his relationship with the studio was with Mosko, so he's leaving. And that's a big blow to Sony, and it comes at an inopportune time because, you know, that was something that was going well for them.
And, you know, I'll just round it out by saying Paul McCartney, meanwhile, is suing to get back some of the Beatles catalog, which...
That's not just... Yeah, that is a big deal as well. Paul McCartney filed a lawsuit against Sony ATV, the publishing company that Sony owns. And, you know, every division now, film, television and music are under fire at Sony in the same week. Not a good time.
It just makes you wonder, can any studio, can the smaller studios, like we've got Hollywood split now. You have Disney, which is part of a giant company with a television network and cable channels. Fox, same thing. NBC Universal, same thing. And then you've got Sony and Viacom, which don't have that kind of corporate setting. And the question is, can they exist? Can these entertainment assets stand in a world of incredible consolidation?
Or do they merge? There's already rumors that Sony would sell some or all of its assets to CBS or Viacom or someone, you know, one of these other players that is looking to get larger, or someone in the tech world, an Apple or Google or someone, one of those kinds of companies, or Netflix, that is just looking for scale in that business.
This is like the parlor game in Hollywood now, guessing whether this they will or won't. Let me just pivot to Legendary. Legendary was bought by the Chinese company Dalian Wanda in a company that was supposedly worth over $3 billion. Who knows what it was really worth? The numbers seem to be a little bit, who knows? And a lot of people wondered, well, you know, what does Legendary have? Thomas Tull, who was the founder, had invested in a number of very successful movies at Warner Brothers, notably Dark Knight and those movies, Inception. He then went over to NBC Universal and invested in some really big movies there, Jurassic World and Straight Outta Compton. But when he made movies himself, as opposed to being allowed to invest, they were movies that notably lately Warcraft and the coming film, The Great Wall. This guy was a real fanboy, I think he truly believed he knew how to get these movies made, but I think he didn't, and Wanda has figured that out.
Yeah, he resigned. you're making the push out the door gesture. So,
yes, I'm pushing.
He resigned from his own company, which typically you don't do unless someone says you will be resigning. They replaced him with an executive at Wanda, whose name I think we'll be hearing a lot more of, Jack Gao.
On an acting basis.
Yeah, they're going to look for someone. But I think this is the first real sign of the impact of Chinese investors in Hollywood, because you have Wanda, which has come in and made a big splash buying Legendary and investing in a lot of films and buying the AMC movie theater chain and buying Dick Clark Productions. And they haven't really done any shakeups. This is the first kind of executive shakeup at a studio that's been purchased or invested in by a Chinese company. And I think a lot of people around town are wondering if this is the sign of the future, where if you take the money, you got to expect that they're going to want some influence, and they're not just buying whatever you want to do. They're going to want some control.
Absolutely. I think, you know, Hollywood wants the money, but they may not want what comes with the money. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. If you remember very little else about the classic Norman Lear sitcom One Day at a Time, you probably remember this. Now, the 94-year-old Lear has overseen a reboot of the show, and that song sounds like this.
This is it. This is life, the one you get to go and have a ball. This is it.
The original One Day at a Time starred Bonnie Franklin as a newly single mother raising two teenage daughters in Indianapolis. In 1975, when the show started its 9-season run, that kind of family setup was not the usual thing depicted on television.
Divorce was against everything I'd ever been taught, but I knew I had to do it.
Now, more than 40 years after the original debuted, the new Netflix One Day at a Time still focuses on a single mom raising a couple of kids, but this time the family is Cuban and lives in the L.A. neighborhood of Echo Park. Mom Penelope, played by Justina Machado, lives with a daughter and a son, as well as her mother Lydia, played by Rita Moreno. In the first episode, the women of the house find themselves at odds as daughter Elena, played by Isabella Gomez, balks at the idea of a traditional celebration of her upcoming 15th birthday.
Your daughter does not want to have a quinceañera.
What? Why? We already booked the room, and I found a great band. Okay, it's a DJ. Okay, it's your brother with an iPod and a playlist, but it's a very good playlist.
I researched the history of quinceañeras and found out they're totally misogynistic.
She's been reading again. Why do you let her read?
The idea of rebooting One Day at a Time with a Latino cast came from Brent Miller, an executive at Norman Lear's Act 3 Productions. Lear and Miller hired our guest today, Gloria Calderon-Kellett, to develop the show. Before One Day at a Time, Calderon-Kellett wrote for shows including How I Met Your Mother and iZombie. She wasn't really looking to work on a reboot, but then she got a fateful phone call.
When somebody says, would you like to sit down and meet with Norman Lear?
I think that's a yes for many people.
You say yes, mm-hmm, and try to seem cool about it. My agents had mentioned he wanted to do a reboot. I didn't know if I was necessarily interested in doing that or not, but I definitely wanted to meet with Norman Lear. So I went.
You think, I'll do the Norman Lear. I'll just have
I'll do
the show
Norman Lear
of
part.
The meeting, right?
Yeah, I'll do the Norman Lear part and get to meet one of my idols. And then, you know, we'll see. And it just became clear very quickly as we started talking and asked me a lot about my family and then talked about what he wanted to do. And Mike was already attached to this. Mike Royce, who was on Everybody Loves Raymond and Men of a Certain Age and Enlisted, he was already attached and they wanted to get an authentic Latino voice, which is good on them because a lot of people haven't cared in the past about
that. So they started out thinking Latino version.
Yes. Brent Miller, who is Norman's producing partner. I think he had read some sort of study that talked about how underserved Latina women, especially single moms, were as an audience.
So he had basically, I mean, it sounds a little odd in a way, but very understandable, gone through a list of any Hispanic woman who had written on TV.
Yeah. All three of us, maybe. I mean, there's not a lot. We know each other and they're all incredible. But yes. And I'm so grateful that I got the knighted. I don't know what the terminology would be.
Damed? I don't know what you say. So before this encounter with Norman Lear, you had come to L.A. You wanted to be an actress.
Yes.
And you were sort of stereotyped as a Hispanic actress, except not really.
Well, yes. I'm too white, apparently. I was told numerous times that I am not Latina enough, even though I'm 100% Latina.
You are Cuban.
I'm Cuban, yes. And I have very dark hair and fair skin. And I often am sort of ethnically ambiguous looking, I guess. And I don't have any accent, as you can hear. My mother made sure that I did not have an accent because she has a very thick one and endured a lot of hurt in her life because of her accent and wanted to make sure her daughter didn't have one. So, yes, it was very interesting to come here. And I've booked parts on television shows playing girls named Maggie and Rachel, you know, white roles, essentially, is what I would end up booking, never a Latino role.
So when you decided the acting thing, I mean, did it just not feel like it was happening?
Well, you know, the auditions I would get when I would go out for Latino roles, it was very stereotyped. And this is 10 years ago. This isn't that long ago.
Right.
And I was like, really? Gangbanger's girlfriend? Like, it was shocking to me that this was, because, you know, you hear about these things and you're like, really, everybody, calm down. It was really the truth.
And yeah, I thought, liberal Hollywood.
Yeah, I thought really there has to be a lawyer or a doctor or a teacher or a, you know, social worker, someone certainly that looks and sounds like me. No? And so I just thought I'll write it for myself. I didn't come out here to be a writer, but I was always the person that could write the paper the night before and get an A and infuriate all my friends. So I did have a love of writing. So I just started sort of teaching myself how to write. And then I went to grad school because I had the desire to continue writing.
I know How I Met Your Mother is
yes.
one of the credits. I mean,
yes.
What was your first job?
My first job was actually on Quintuplets, which was a Fox series starring Andy Richter. I had started putting up monologue shows. I'd started putting up plays because I know how to do that. It doesn't require any money, very little money. And that's really what started my career is putting up my own plays.
Wow. So you did that, and then you got hired on Quintuplets.
I got hired on, actually, Ortega's. A writer's assistant first.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, the buzz from the monologue shows was getting out there, agent and manager, like I said, and they started sending me out to pitch television shows, which I had never worked on, knew nothing about. No one in my family is in the industry. And I went to my first meeting. It was HBO, I remember so specifically. And I walked in there in my business suit because I don't know what writers dress like.
Slobs, in my experience.
Slobs is what we dress like. In a business
suit. Not today.
Suit.
You look
no.
lovely.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, I am Cuban. I always have a little bit of a lipstick and a little bit of a style. So I went and I could tell the looks on these guys' faces as they were listening to my pitch was like, oh, isn't she cute? She doesn't know what she's doing. And I hated it. And so I left and I said, no, I won't do that again. I need to sit down with a showrunner. And Mark Reisman, who was a writer on Frasier, was kind enough to sit down with me. And I barraged him with questions that he was very kind in answering. And then he got a show on the air, which was Quintuplets, and he hired me.
So how did you actually get him to sit down with you?
I asked my manager and agent, I said, I'll sit down with anyone who's a showrunner. And I think they were friends with him, and he was kind enough to do it. He had also helped Danielle Sanchez, who now runs The Carmichael Show. So both of us have, you know, really have to credit.
He's a mentor.
Yeah. Bless him that he allowed me to really pick his brain in the way he did. And, you know, at the end, he's like, kid, you got moxie. You're going to be okay.
Yes.
And then he hired me. And on his show, I met Carter Bays and Craig Thomas, who did How I Met Your Mother. And that's how I got that job. And the rest is history.
So when you were hired for those, you know, you were stereotyped as an actress, but were you stereotyped as a writer?
Well, initially I was the diversity hire, which is a very difficult thing to go in and do. This is
they
no
actually
longer
call you the diversity. They say, yeah. Hi, you are the. It's not uh-huh. like you felt like you were the diversity.
No,
hire.
No, you are the diversity hire.
They tell you this.
It's some sort of quota or something, and the studio will pay you, so you don't come out of the budget of the show, which is I think initially was set up as a benefit, like hey, it doesn't cost you any money, and you get another writer in there. But it started to be looked down upon, and people used to be really annoyed by having to hire a diverse, you know,
right.
And you feel that when you go in, like, oh, so that's the one that was hired because her last name's Calderon. And so I felt that immediately what I needed to do was assimilate, was show them that I could hang just like they could hang. And I could be funny and raw and do all the things the boys could do. I mean, already female is its own diversity. And then Latina is its own diversity as well. And so I really tried to do that. And I was fortunate to have kind people. I had not great people, too, on staffs, but I've been very lucky to have people that have mentored me along the way.
So then you get to this show, and it is a reboot. And, you know, I mean, because so many of them aren't good, I would assume there was some pressure.
There, of course. Well, just Norman Lear's show. I mean, having that banner, wanting to live up to this pedigree that this man has set up, of course there was pressure on us. But he very early on in the process told both Mike Royce and I that this was really just a starting off point. It was really a reimagining. Take the single mom thing and run with it. So once we heard from him that we weren't taking these characters 10 years later.
Right.
It was really kind
There's
of its own thing.
To the show,
there's some throwbacks, but yeah. We really had the freedom to create our own thing and to really mine from our own lives. And that's when our brains really started percolating and we got very excited.
Well, so your parents actually came over as part of the what's called, I guess, the Pedro Pan.
Mm-hmm. Operation Pedro Pan.
Operation, which removed young people from Cuba because obviously Castro.
Mm-hmm.
And they were separated from their parents when they were like 15.
That's correct.
And your parents came later.
Yeah, my grandparents.
Your grandparents,
my
I'm
grandparents
sorry.
Were able to come on the freedom flights a little bit later. But it was a very harrowing experience. I can only speak from my experience, but my grandfather did tell me at one point that soldiers broke in the middle of the night with machine guns. And that's when he decided, oh, this is not the Cuba that I know. I got to get the girls out of here. I can't imagine. I have two children and I cannot imagine how frightening it must have been to put their kids on a plane and not know if and when you were going to see them again. And I really credit the courage of my grandparents for doing that. But, you know, they loved Cuba. My mom still can't talk about it without getting very emotional. You know, something beautiful was ripped from them in their mind. And they're so grateful to the United States for taking them in and supporting them and allowing them to thrive. And I think I'm the product of that, which I'm very grateful for.
Well, I would imagine, and maybe this is overly simplistic thinking, that when you're talking about a Latino version of One Day at a Time, people would think Mexican.
We actually did get that phone call. I told Mike, too. I was like, we're going to get the phone call at some point just because, and I understand it from a population point of view, there are more Mexicans than there are Cubans. But we are really different. All of us are really different. We have a lot of commonality, obviously, and a lot of crossover. But in order for, I couldn't, as a Cuban, write the same way with the same freedoms if I were writing a Mexican family, only because I feel comfortable making fun of Cubans because I'm Cuban, you know? So I can do it.
It might be a little awkward to make fun of Mexicans.
Right,
especially
right.
Since there is, you know, intergroup rivalry.
Right, there is. And that's something I really hope so much that we can put an end to because I'm really inspired by the Black community and how they've come together to support one another in their projects. And I want the Latino community to do the same.
So Norman Lear says, you're Latina? And you say, yes, I'm Cuban. And does he say, well, then let's make it Cuban? Do you say it?
No, I say it. Yeah, mm-hmm. I say I would like to make it Cuban. I mean, I could have written a Mexican family and I maybe would still like to in the future write a Mexican family. It's just different. It's just a different, there's different things I would do. There's different things in the household. There's different foods that you eat. So for this specific show, I just knew I could do so much with the Cuban experience. So much of the pride I have in being Cuban and the stories that I have from my personal life, I wanted to use. And so I'm really grateful that him and Mike both fought to keep it Cuban.
Coming up after a short break, Gloria Calderon-Kellett tells us about the art of shooting in front of a live studio audience and the one line from the pilot that Netflix wanted to change. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to writer-producer Gloria Calderon-Kellett about the new Netflix series, One Day at a Time. The show is based on the Norman Lear sitcom of the same name that ran for 9 seasons starting in 1975. In the new version, Justina Machado plays Penelope Alvarez, a Cuban-American nurse and veteran who's separated from her husband and raising 2 kids. Because this is still a Norman Lear sitcom, the show does deal with serious issues. Early in the series, Penelope goes on antidepressants, which upsets her mother, played by Rita Moreno.
You don't need drugs. You need your husband.
Oh, God, stop it. Stop. Victor is not the answer.
I know you didn't want him to go back to Afghanistan, but he's making money. He's being a good provider.
There are jobs here where they don't shoot at you.
We live in America. Name one.
It's not just the job, and you know that.
It's not like he cheated on you.
It's not the only thing that matters.
We are Cuban. We don't get divorced. We die.
Calderon Kellett thought of Rita Moreno for the show from the start.
In that first conversation with Norman, he asked me to talk about my mom, and my mom and Rita resemble each other. My mom is, you know, 5-foot boob popsicle, 98 pounds maybe, wet, and a powerhouse of a woman. So when I talked about her, I said, just picture Rita Moreno. And then I told the stories. And he was like, oh, my gosh, you know, I love Rita. And I would love to do something with Rita. Let's call her. Because, you know, in the world of Norman Lear, he just picks up the phone.
Rita Moreno, sure.
And so we did. And said, we want you to do the show. And she said, okay, you know. And I didn't know that that meant actually okay. And so she did it.
I mean, I think anybody who's not inspired by a 94-year-old Norman Lear and an 85-year-old Rita Moreno is not thinking about their future at all.
No, it's really amazing. It's very comforting to know if you take some physical care of yourself and also have purpose.
And have really good genes.
Well, and they have purpose. They both live with such purpose. They are so active and so interested in remaining relevant, and that's really inspiring.
So the writer's room, how did you think about putting that together?
Well, having been the only diversity in the room a lot, it was really important to me that we have a room that reflected what was in front of the camera. And again, this is I said this to Mike and Norman, and they were only supportive. They were like, yes, sounds great. I mean, Mike was like, let's read everybody we can read. And we did. But still, when you call agencies and say we would like you to send Latino writers to us, there's not a lot of writers that they send. We still have a lot of work to do on that front. And I know they're out there, so it's just that they're not being seen yet, or they don't know the means to get representation. And it's one of the reasons why I still teach. I teach at Loyola Marymount in the off season to sort of cultivate the next generation of voices.
So you were at Netflix. I don't know if it was always there.
That just made the most sense to us. I think that being able to create 13, being able to arc out something and tell a complete story was very attractive. And obviously Netflix is like the cool kid, so who doesn't want to be like hanging out with the cool kid?
Well, except it's mysterious and they don't necessarily tell you what you're – they don't tell you anything, basically.
Right, right.
As we know from having had other people on the show who were there, they tell you nothing.
Yes.
And so you don't – you know, you got great reviews, but you don't really know anything else.
Right.
Which is a little like – no feedback. I mean, it could be great.
For me, it's great. Listen, for me, it's great because I trust that they will get it out there. And it, by the way, even the binging process is so – I've never worked in something where everyone saw all the episodes and are already reaching out
to us. Well, the critics are – a couple of TV writers and critics have said they binged it.
Yes.
Which is nice, right?
It's very nice. I'm so complimented and humbled by it.
It's very traditional in terms of format.
Like, yes.
It's a sitcom. Live audience.
Live
it
audience.
Sounds like a live audience.
It
I have
is.
To admit, when I started watching it, I was sort of like, oh, we're doing this?
Yes. A lot of people are like, the canned laughter. It's not canned. It's an audience. We actually turned it down a lot. We didn't sweeten laughs. You know, I'm a playwright by nature, and this is really a play in front of an audience. So you sort of get to be at home participating in that.
I almost wondered, is it somewhat a lost art to do that from the acting point of view, especially some of the younger ones?
Yes. Well, these are a lot of theater actors, too. Justina Machado came from the Chicago theater scene. Obviously, Rita is an amazing theater actress, and Stephen Tobolowsky. These are theater actors, so they're able to flex those theater muscles in this.
So Norman, we've talked about this on this very show, you know, had his battles with censors over the years. Now, Netflix is not known for censorship,
no.
But there was some argument about somebody was referring to Jesus. And
yeah.
And who was pushing back on that?
Well, you know, it wasn't actually pushback. What it was is we didn't intend to have a show with swearing, but we thought what happens in real families is sometimes words slip out. So wouldn't it be cool if we can swear the way people in real life swear? Whereas you do it and immediately go, don't, that's not a word we use.
And who, the line is?
Penelope, the mother, finds out that her son has been, in a way, stealing. He's been buying shoes through Zappos, wearing them with tape on the bottom, taking the tape off and sending them back. And she finds out about this and she's like, well, that, you know, the shoes are going to be perfect. That's some Jesus shit right there. And that was the line that I'd pitched to Mike and it made him laugh and went in the script. And then we did it. It got a laugh every single time in front of the audience, got a huge laugh. And then Netflix came to us and said, listen, we've seen the other episodes that you've sent us. We'd sent them several scripts by then. They knew the tone of the show and what we were going for. You don't have any swearing in those episodes. And we're like, no, we don't. We don't really think we are going to. They said, well, if this was a show where that was going to be a thing, then that's one thing. But know that according to our numbers, there are families who will watch this show. And the moment there is swearing like that, they will stop watching because they'll be nervous. Like, oh, this is a show I can't watch with my kids because there's swearing in it, which makes total sense to me. And they said, so we give you the information. Do the joke if you want to do the joke. Just know you might lose some people. I mean, and then they walked away really leaving it to us to do whatever we wanted to do with it, to their credit. And Norman is so amazing because he's just, you know, let's do it anyway. Who cares? And I'm like, no, Norman, this is a Latino family. I can't have people change the channel. If it was like a story point or something, that would have been one thing. But for one joke, I couldn't. So we made a Jesus crap instead. And that's what you see on your television.
It went by so fast, I did not like bump on it at all.
Well,
not
good,
that
good,
I probably wouldn't
good.
Have bumped on the other line either, but I'm just saying. So did you shoot all of these episodes and then drop it on Netflix? Is that how it works?
Yes.
So, I mean, because one of the things that is also a hallmark of Norman Lear is topicality.
Yes.
And you can't react, like, I know, not to name drop, but at the Golden Globes, I ran into Kenya Barris, and he was very excited about his election show, which
yes,
he had written and directed.
Right.
And, you know, they're shooting and airing and shooting, so he can do that. For you, you can do topics, I guess. But
we can be relevant, but not topical.
Which is, so it goes, right?
Yeah. And, you know, the sad truth of it is the Latino experience in the last few years hasn't changed that much, unfortunately. So the stuff we're talking about is stuff that still needs to be talked about from even 10 years ago. We couldn't do anything on the election because we knew we would be airing after. We didn't know who was going to win at the time that we were doing these. But we still have so much to talk about. So that is one of the things that Norman bumps on. You know, it bumps him out that we can't talk about something immediately because we do create them in a bubble. We stopped shooting in August and then went into editing. So all of this is new material. But I think we'll be able to touch on it, hopefully on the B-side in some sort of relevant way.
So I guess the takeaway would be if you're going to do a reboot, they oftentimes depart radically from the it's not like they're always slavishly following the previous formula.
Right.
I don't know. Is there a lesson to learn about, or is it just one of those lightning in a bottle things that this one worked?
I think lightning in a bottle. I mean, a lot of people have been asking, you know, why One Day at a Time? If I were to watch the show and the character wasn't named Schneider, I wouldn't even know. And it's because it started with Norman. You know, had Mike and I gone out and tried to pitch this show in the way that we wanted to write it, which is in this way, I think people might have been confused. What do you mean? There's going to be crying in episodes? It's a comedy. I think they would have been confused. The moment you say Norman, they go, oh, okay, I get what you're doing. So I don't know that we could have made it without that. And it really started with him. This started with him coming to us with this thing and giving us the freedom to do our own thing with it. So all of the pieces came together in a really fortuitous way.
And you still have that Norman Lear DNA.
Yep.
Gloria Calderon Kellett is the executive producer of One Day at a Time on Netflix. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance this week from Ray Guarna and J.C. Swadek. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.